Hello and welcome to today's episode of CyberSpeak with InfoSec Institute. Our guest today is John Dixon, who has been researching and following the security concerns surrounding the 2018 U.S. midterm elections. John Dixon is an internationally recognized security leader, entrepreneur, and principal at Denham Group Limited. He has nearly 20 years hands-on experience in intrusion detection, network security, and application security in the commercial, public, and military sectors. As a Denham Group principal, he helps executives and chief security officers of Fortune 500 companies and government organizations launch and expand their critical application security initiatives. His leadership has been instrumental in Denham Group being honored by Inc. magazine as one of the fastest growing companies in the industry for 5 years in a row. John, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Chris. I'm glad to be here.
Great. So could you give us, to start with, a little capsule summary of the history of electronic security issues with voting? Obviously, ballot stuffing and fake votes have been with us since the start of voting, but when and where did specifically electronic issues start appearing in the voting process?
Wow, that's a broad question, but I would say concerns around the integrity of the system really predate 2016, but I would argue that much of the energy has been around what we call vote tabulation or vote counting and the integrity of the vote count. You know, what's the precision and, you know, whether or not there could be fraud committed at the polling station via a voting machine. Hence the this whole movement by political scientists and activists around having a paper receipt. That is, a paper receipt ensures the integrity of the actual tabulation of the one person. So it's harder for dead people to vote. It's harder for manipulation by people that are trying to manipulate the outcome of an individual election. What I would argue that has happened in the last since 2016 and continues to happen is an attack by nation states on trying to undermine the credibility and the integrity of the election in general. And what my strong feeling is, this is a very different phenomenon. And as a matter of fact, actually going after the tabulation and trying to manipulate the outcome is not necessary if you're trying to undermine the confidence in the system. There's so many other easy ways to attack it. And again, the one thing I like to point out to folks, one thing that the Russians are better at than cyber is disinformation and deception, and they have hundreds of years worth of practice. And so, like, the cyber part is just another way to do it.
So I guess jumping to that, what are the sort of the practical security issues around the midterm election? From a cybersecurity perspective, what could realistically happen? You mentioned, obviously, that there's an undermining of the sort of confidence in the system, but sort of practically speaking, how big of a margin could security and cyber tampering actually go in altering an election?
I would say the things that I've focused on reporting are more the fixed assets. You know, this is these are assets that exist. They're not ephemeral. They're not temporary. And the nature of election machines and voting machines and precincts is they're temporary. You know, so if you're going to go after voting machines, you have two options. One is to break into the secure storage facility where they live 300 and so days of the year. And the other way is to actually go into precincts and try to physically go or to co-opt an election judge. Those are particularly tricky ways to do, to undermine a system and actually put people in harm's way. So what I would argue that is a bigger risk if you're trying, and again, you have to think like the attacker, you have to think like the Russians. I would point to voter registration systems as a great example. Voter registration logs, poisoning of those logs as a great example of undermining confidence. The scenario is that, you know, people go to polls, they look and they're not on the poll, they're not on the list of registered voters. The second thing that I have mentioned is election night reporting. The ability to DDoS most of the Secretary of State's and most of the county reporting infrastructure exists right now. And I will just say, I would point to, I think it's Lexington County in Tennessee that had a small election earlier in the year and they experienced a DDoS. It's just so easy to do. And I mean, you throw in some social media posts, some fake news, some bot news, and you know, you can make it seem like there's, you know, the system's under attack, and that would be a fairly straightforward thing to do without putting people in harm's way, without trying to change the vote count. That's what I am, you know, what I'm worried about. And I would say this as a general theme is you've basically taken all of these secretaries of states and county voting administrators and put them on the front line of a cyber war, and you couldn't have a bigger mismatch of talent, technical, and defenses. Yeah. So I think there's a lot of catching up to do. It's a, you know, it's my, I read an interesting foreign policy article about the Cold War and how we, the US essentially did this from 1945 to 1991, which was in the context of the domino theory and all that, we actually went and manipulated votes in different, in the developing world. The fact that the Russians haven't done it until now is to some degree astounding.
Yeah. Why do you think, I guess maybe why do you think they haven't done it till now? And I guess I, you know, the answer is itself why they're doing it now, but like why do you think they just sort of quote unquote hit on the idea?
You know, social media didn't exist in the 50s and 60s. So there's an easier venue to poison the news cycle, if that makes sense. I mean, you had to go through news bureaus or through reporters. It's just easier. People consume news from less formal sources, less centralized sources. So that's one thing. But I think the stakes are different. Like, you know, we went tit for tat during the Cold War and everything. Hence the, you know, going country for country and I think we don't view this as pernicious of a threat. It's now coming around. I mean, from 1991 until recently, you know, we were quote unquote at peace with the Russians. Most people in the national security world have known that they have maintained their kind of posture and never fully got over the collapse of the Soviet Union, and to some degree feel that they owe us one. Hence. Mm-hmm. You know, they view like our use of the Voice of America as manipulating their population. Mm-hmm. That, you know, we've done this for years, trying to manipulate them and trying to point them, their population in a direction that's different. How is this different? The fact that they totally disclaim it is, you know, at times is incredible. And then the other thing that they have is they have with RT and some of the newer venues, and they have more credible news sources than Pravda and yep. Some of the Cold War places. They look real. And if you go, I love reading, going online and reading their English versions of events that happened and just like seeing our interpretation, then you go reading the British interpretations, the French, German, and then going and reading Pravda or RT News. And it's just incredible. It's like we live in a different world, you know?
It is, and it's also interesting to, I mean, you also see a lot of those articles about sort of struggling U.S. journalists who get that call and say, oh, I can pad up my resume by working for RT News, and then realizing sort of what they've gotten themselves into. And
I would agree.
That they've have this sort of like given this face of credibility to like blatant disinformation.
No, I agree with that. And this is what's so, I think, tragic about this whole thing about fake news is again, you know, they've been at it for, you know, at least 60, 70 years. Mm-hmm. And I like, so this is sad that it actually, you know, that we have become less distrustful, of what comes out of that. You know, we viewed it as claims. And I'll tell you a great example is back a few months ago, maybe longer than months ago, when we, struck the Syrian, facilities after they did the chemical attack. I guess it was like a year ago. Right afterwards, I hopped online and I was looking for some stuff. And on YouTube, there were all these videos about cruise missile shootdowns that all came out about the same time. And they were all like from news bots and different folks. The reality of it is I think we fired 40 or 50 odd cruise missiles. The combat planners always put way more into the planning, and they to service a target. So if they did, even if they did have four or five of them shot down, the reason they sent so many is because they want to make sure they have target coverage. And I know that I used to be an Air Force guy. They don't just send one bomb for one target. They So like it's a total, but that was immediately, it was put up. It was the same video from different sources, and their ability to respond and react is it's less about the cyber and cybersecurity world and cyber war and all that. It's more about information warfare. It's the information itself. And, you know, we've got just such a receptive audience now on this side of the pond that it's, like I said, it's sad.
Yeah. So going back to the sort of county and local issues of, you know, election day issues and stuff like that, what tactics should citizens, poll watchers, and polling places use to avoid these sort of social engineering techniques or these sort of muddying of the voter registration lists and things like that? Like what are some of the sort of practical things that we should be watching out for on the day of that we
can use? You know, I think the, let me start at the top. It's really the majority of the focus should be at the secretaries of state, because those are the aggregation points. Those are the ones that set the tone for their individual states. And for the record, these elections are purely a state and local function. There's, you know, a federal input and federal monies, but for the most part, this is a state and local effort. So at the aggregation points, I would say, you know, at the secretaries of state, Texas, where I live, has 254 counties. So, you know, and there's probably 4 to 8 major urban counties, including like Houston, Dallas, San Antonio, Austin. You know, those are different than some of the rural counties in West Texas, where they don't even have an IT guy in their elections group. And then, you know, and the other thing is, like, our challenge down here is, even within Texas, all the election systems are voting systems are different. So in a weird way, we have this protection in that they're not connected, number one, and number two, they're all over the place. So that provides protection. So it's really the secretaries of states and the voting election heads of each of those counties. And as far as actual election judges at the precincts, I think that's just simply, you know, you do some awareness training, you start to weave in that with, but candidly, I don't believe that's where the risk is from where we live right now.
Sort of another story that I hear occasionally getting reported is sort of phishing campaigns that use emails or phone calls to gather voter information or disseminate fake information in the form of phone polling, or even attempts to harvest registration information via phone. Is that also a credible threat? And what should sort of voters in the home do to keep themselves and information protected as we come into the election season?
Well, Chris, if you think about it, how many of the fake phone calls have you gotten your cell phone about extending the warranty on your car?
Yeah.
Or, you know,
right.
Those are done through voice over IP and done through call centers that have been, you know, essentially fake call centers. I'm not aware of that being done, but technically it's very easy to do. I mean, right now you've got robocalls as part of a campaign. Push polls is a political thing where you ask poll, you know, you call to do polls that seem very tilted one way or the other. So we have a history of, you know, political manipulation of elections on our own end, you know, hence the secretaries of state and the Federal Election Commission. Is it easier for somebody to do that from overseas? You better believe it. And so that's the challenge is, you know, and this distrust of government now has started to extend to the polling places and to individual, you know, voting precincts. So that's probably the biggest thing is I think the starting point for this discussion is distrust in government. And that distrust is extended to the voting systems, whether we like it or not. And as a result, you've got this, you know, this perfect mix of challenges. One thing I was going to pass on, I actually got to go to a psychological warfare training class when I was in the Air Force, best training class I've ever been to. Wow. And the one thing that I remember from that class is you don't just outright lie, because that's not well received. People are not stupid. You take a pre-existing perception and you tweak it a little bit. And again, I would argue that the Russians are better at disinformation and information warfare. They know our stuff. You know, those ads where they tried to foment, you know, distrust around racial things. And like, and I think I heard recently that they were doing some paid ads and things around Texas, you know, Texas seceding from the union. Just kind of like crazy stuff that,
yeah.
I mean, like, yeah, there are a few, you know, folks in West Texas and compounds and probably think that way, but like, it's not remotely a mainstream thought, but they love that. Whatever they can do to fragment and disunify the West and the U.S. and such, is that's their goal. So all this is through the lens of what their goal is, which is to undermine the U.S. and its position in the world, and also undermine democracy as we know it.
Now, again, from a tech standpoint, I know we're not there yet, but I've heard talk that as soon as the 2020 presidential election, we could be moving towards an all electronic voting process. Do you think there's increased dangers around that? Do you think that's actually a possibility? And is it even possible to make all electronic voting safer than our current method, or is the seal box nature of it a disaster waiting to happen, do you think?
I think that in the long view, long term, you know, underlying technologies like blockchain will make this much more straightforward. I think, you know, if you were to fast forward 50 years, 100 years and talk about paper ballots, I mean, paper ballots in 2018 are anachronistic.
They're a
coping mechanism that harkens back to a previous age. Oh, if we could just see it in paper.
Right.
And if you're a fraudster, you're going to find another way to attack the system. You know, and that's so there's other ways to do it. But my point is, I think that the fragmented nature of acquisition, it makes this a challenge. Now, the Election Assistance Commission and kind of the feds have done a good job about certifying systems. I think that's how you solve this problem, is you pick two or three vendors, you work with them, and you have two or three reference models that are able to do this well, and then you do it through that supply chain. The problem is that starting point for that world is not particularly advanced in security world, security area. So if you look at, like, you know, Diebold and some of the people that make ATMs, I mean, they've been doing this stuff for 25, 30, 40 years. Obviously, they understand concepts like host security modules, private key encryption. They get all that. They've been doing it for, like, you know, for 40 or 50 years.
I can't think of but once in 20 years that I've gotten too much or too little money out of an ATM. Like, it's just like right on the mark there, you know. So
it always is. And but the interesting thing there, obviously they're worried about the integrity of the transactions and the confidentiality of your PINs as you enter them. Mm-hmm. But I, you know, to give you some sense, 20 years ago, I did an audit for KPMG of ATM systems, and they were super mature back then. They've been mature forever. So this is and again, the use case for an ATM is physical. It's there all the time. And it's got tamper proof. So now you have these attackers that pull up, you know, their pickup trucks and try to pull the whole machine
out.
That's something we can do it.
Right.
But voting machine use case is a lot more challenging. You have this basic temporary infrastructure that's up and running for just a couple of times a year. And so I told you the Texas challenge where there's 254 counties. I live in what's called Bear County in San Antonio, which is one of the larger urban counties in Texas. And I think we have somewhere around 2,500 machines for, you know, upwards to 300 voting locations on a presidential. I mean, somewhere in there. But, I mean, the numbers are humongous. So, you know, and if you do what we call in the IT world a forklift upgrade, I mean, those are lots and lots of money. And I would argue that right now the existing machines – that are out there do not solve the problem against the nation state threat. Maybe future machines will, but the current machines simply don't do that. And we actually have security through obscurity in Texas because most, if not all of our machines are not connected to the internet.
So, do you think we'll ever get to a point where this might just be like total pie in the sky, but I know people have said for years, like, we get to a point where, you know, yeah, you could vote like you use an ATM, or you could vote like you call in for American Idol or whatever. Do you think that polling places are also going to become anachronistic eventually?
If you look at it this way, think about what you can do online with your banks. I mean, virtually everything. And the stakes are even higher. So the question is, you know, they have a profit motive to innovate and to roll these technologies out. The challenge is the voting administrators don't have that profit motive. Probably don't have the best and brightest in e-commerce and digital transactions, is a nice way to put it. So, I mean, like, it'll be slow for adoption because I think the numbers are just off the charts expensive. And again, you don't have the profit motive. The next time they have a refresh might be after 2020. And, you know, the number that I heard in our county is tens of millions, like the low tens of millions to do a refresh. So multiply that over all the different counties. And I mean, it's probably a $1 trillion number, or maybe not trillion, but hundreds of billions of dollars across all of the different voting precincts. And again, the technical debt, go to Cook County in Chicago, I mean, like, how many voting machines exist on the planet, or at least in the U.S.? I don't know that number, but it has to be hundreds of thousands, I would suspect.
Sure.
Yeah.
Now, are there any safeguards in place with regards to that would even be able to detect that tampering has taken place? Will we even know the extent of?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, the good news about the underlying blockchain stuff is they're, you know, essentially tamper proof. You have an encrypted hash that could essentially validate that you have voted and this person has voted for this person. But that's, you know, potentially years away. The question is, how quickly will our municipalities, our counties, our states adopt this, and at what pace is the question? Now, here's what I would say, knowing what I know about technology. We might buy our way out of solving that problem, and there will likely be other problems that we can't even foresee at this point. So, I mean, the stakes are so high. The way that I put it is we have a delicate democracy, and this is the delicate part of that delicate democracy. Mm-hmm. And the fact that the Russians hadn't done this before is actually kind of flabbergasting. And so, you know, it is, we're going to have to change our game. We're going to have to, this is the role of a Secretary of State and the role of a county election administrator suddenly changed, I would argue.
Jumping back from elections to political party security and stuff, there was a story a few weeks ago at a hacker conference in which a teenager said he was basically easily able to hack into a political party's website. Why is this still the easiest thing in the world to do? Is it just people aren't taking the notion of security on their site seriously even after 2016?
Okay, so, you know, if you look at the world, look at presidential campaigns, which have, you know, senatorial campaigns, congressional campaigns. Okay, so there are 100 senators. That means that there's probably 200 people running, but they don't run all at the same time, every 6 years, right? Okay. I mean, there's hundreds and hundreds of campaigns. But if you go down to state reps, state senators, local races, there's thousands and thousands and thousands. The vast majority of them don't even have an IT person. The vast majority of them. So the interesting thing that I would say that's out there is I saw an FEC filing about Microsoft rolling out a secure version of infrastructure for campaigns. I think when Microsoft and Google do that, that will solve the problem. The only catch is the FEC, the Federal Election Commission, is pushing back and wondering if that is too generous a donation. Like the fact that Microsoft and Google would curry favor with every candidate and elected official by doing it. But candidly, that's the even if it was provided at a low fee, I've argued that like you basically have to have a secure campaign in a box, which means like as you like the equivalent of a install shield type of thing where you go in and say, okay, you're the candidate. Okay, hey, give me your phone number. Hey, we're going to set this up by default. You're going to have strong, you know, two-factor auth. We're going to text you this. Like, oh, you're the campaign manager. We're gonna, you know, like basically so that a user could do it. I mean, long story made short is most campaigns don't have a dedicated IT staff. They sure as heck don't have a security smart person. So it's going to remain a target-rich environment. I look forward to seeing what is out there. I do like what Microsoft did. And again, I think Google's probably going to respond with their Gmail equivalent. But they're running into oversight issues about, you know, influence. That's kind of interesting. But
yeah, absolutely. Now, Do you think what sort of education initiatives do you think should be undertaken to bring the voting populace a bit more up to speed about the current dangers? I mean, it's easy to talk about things on an administrative level and stuff, but you know, again, with the fear of, you know, fake news and stuff, like, is there any kind of messages that we can get out about your vote and, you know, how to protect it?
I think, you know, the good old public service announcements might help. I would argue that, unfortunately, at least at certain levels, we have mixed messages coming from the top. Mm-hmm. This is a nice way to say it without being too political. So, I mean, that's the problem. If you've got, candidly, if you've got, you know, the guy at the top that's you know, actively undermining certain aspects of things and saying this is all fake news and whatever, I mean, like, it's hard to... So I have friends that still believe, you know, that they weren't involved. And I said they were absolutely involved. You know, whether or not it tipped the scales the last election, who knows? Maybe not. But I mean, to say that they were not involved at all is crazy land, I would argue. And so that's the problem is, you know, how do you educate voters? I mean, that how do you, you know, that's a tough societal problem. I don't know. That's, you know, way above my pay grade.
Yeah. Well, let's sort of play that out a little bit. I mean, going past the 2018 midterms and into the 2020 presidential and other local things, you know, what would your mix be of social engineering education versus software fraud? Like, what are the long-term campaigns that we could kind of get in place so that we feel, because it always seems like every election comes along and we're kind of, you know, no one's prepared for it. There's all these new threats and stuff. Like, what would your long-term strategy be for sort of the safety of future elections?
The thing that I would remind you is that, you know, having worked on campaigns, the number one focus and number two, number three, number four of the campaign is to win the campaign. Mm-hmm. You don't want to lose and have the most locked down and well done, you know, campaign and be number two. So that's the focus of the campaigns exclusively is to win. The challenge is, again, you've got election administrators, candidates and campaigns, and then thirdly, the voting populace. I think it's difficult to boil the ocean. And I think you start with the leadership and the you know, and they will message this out. I've actually encouraged local administrators and state administrators to reach out to their press and before the midterms have a rapport with them and talk to them about what they're doing, to have tabletop exercises so that if there is an event, they can say, hey, remember back in September when we went through this stuff? You know, that's what we were about. This is exactly what happened. And then that's, you know, that's pretty cool versus no engagement. And then the press puts out something that is, says, you know, voting election gets hacked by Russians, you know, when in fact it's a denial of service attack from somewhere, you know, I think educating, having the top level, you know, voting administrators, the leaders, educate the press is another thing. And I mean, I've been told that's naive, but I still feel very strongly about that. If you wait for it to come to you, good luck on whatever headlines are written.
Do you think that there's could be some modification of the procedure within campaigns or within the local level to make sure that discovering tampering and cybercrime can be properly triaged and reported? You know, because it seems like there's stories of, well, I got fished, but I didn't tell my IT person because I was embarrassed and things like that.
No, I think I would say at the very national level, I think at the presidential campaigns, you're going to have that. You're going to have a lot more awareness. You're probably going to have a CISO. You're probably going to have a CIO. But that's at that level. Maybe not even at the senatorial level, gubernatorial level. That's you're going to have that. So I think we're going to probably have to have more hiccups for this to become real. The guys that I know that are running for office, and I know a bunch in our backyard, are aware of this issue. They're conscious, and we are working with at least one congressional candidate to help him do the right things. But for the most part, this is, you know, a nice to do activity. And of the many competing issues, fundraising, positioning, polling, I mean, like having your cybersecurity down is just, it, candidly, is not on the radar screen. Right. And until we have more of these, you know, issues, I think it'll remain that way.
Where do cloud services play into all of this? Wasn't there a huge issue of a huge breach of voter data in California in which the cloud server was backed up without a password? I guess if you're talking about like campaigns in a box and stuff, that might be
a Do I have more faith in Google and Microsoft to roll out a secure version of something? Yeah. Yes, I do. Then every individual campaign rolling their own. Absolutely. So I think that, I think that rings true if you are, you know, you can custom do certain things at the federal level. But again, the local campaigns don't even have an IT person. So I would worry more about them trying to do their own thing. Then there's probably more hope in having the bigger guys provide something that is easily consumed, is a nice way to put it.
Okay, so I'm going to start sort of circling toward a wrap up here. But if you were given a magic legislative gavel to put a parcel of laws in place to make voting safer and more accurate, what law or laws or would you enact?
I would have rigorous testing of the voting infrastructure at the state level. I mean, to replicate a sophisticated threat, what they call essentially adversarial or like threat mimicking. You know, so much of the testing and things that they're doing to see if they're, you know, vulnerable, you know, it's kind of garden variety vulnerability scanning. So I would say it's that threat emulation, and a threat emulation, what that means in English is like, you know, more than technical scanning, actual hands-on penetration testing with social engineering, with a targeted, you know, targeted phishing attack. You add all that stuff, that replicates what the Russians would do, along with, you know, some social engineering outside of the election officials. I mean, the tabletops that I see that exercise this are mostly corporate facing, but I do think you're going to have, like, if you were to do a tabletop exercise and prepare Secretary of State, much of what you're worried about is external reaction to other events, and including the press. And I just don't, in spite of the warnings, I don't have a warm fuzzy that most of the states are ready for that particular sophisticated threat.
And that's too bad, as my last question was sort of a warm and fuzzy one. Do you have any rays of hope for the possible safety and accuracy of this next election versus previous ones?
I have hope that the heterogeneous nature of our voting machines is so widespread that, you know, it's kind of the cathode ray tube defense that the Russians had during the Cold War. They weren't susceptible to EMP because they had outdated technology. So in a weird way, our attack surface is pretty low. I'm more worried about the aggregation points. I'm more worried about the fact that our secretaries of state haven't realized that this is more of an information warfare activity than it is a cyber one. So the responses are more technical in nature. So I, you know, like anything that happens in this realm, you have to have a series of near-death experiences before you realize it, or, you know, because, yeah. You know, otherwise it's an abstract risk that I just kind of accept. If it becomes less abstract, then people pay attention.
Well, and on that note, I think we're going to wrap up today. Thank you, John Dixon, very much for your insights. And
this is my pleasure. Fun stuff, man. And let's keep in touch.
Absolutely. Thank you. And thank you all for listening and watching. If you enjoyed today's video, you can find many more on our YouTube page. Just go to YouTube and type in InfoSec Institute to check out our collection of tutorials, interviews, and past webinars. If you'd rather have us in your ears during your workday, all of our videos are also available as audio podcasts. Please visit InfoSecInstitute.com/cyberspeak for the full list of episodes. If you'd like to qualify for a free pair of headphones with a class sign up, podcast listeners can go to infosecinstitute.com/podcast to learn more. And if you'd like to try our free security IQ package, which includes phishing simulators in which you can fake phish and then educate your colleagues and friends in the ways of security awareness, please visit infosecinstitute.com/security IQ. Thanks once again to John Dixon, and thank you all for watching and listening, and we will speak with you next week.